Wonderful. So it's such a pleasure to be here, and I think the previous presentation was a really sad but effective way to frame this presentation in particular, which might serve as almost a case study to examine the cycles of violence that occur in particular contexts. I'm Jocelyn Kelly. I'm the research coordinator for the Women in War program at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. And I'll be presenting results from a qualitative study that we did in Eastern DRC between 2007 and 2008. I'd like to start by thanking our partners, both our local partner called the Centre d'Assistance Médico-Psychosociale, who we work with in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and without whom none of this work would be possible. I'd also like to thank our funder, the Open Society Institute, and to report that I have no relationships or conflicts of interest to disclose. I'd like to give you a very brief background on the Democratic Republic of the Congo, although I'm sure many of you in the audience are already familiar with this conflict. It's been going on for over two decades and was precipitated by the Rwandan genocide, but has been fueled by the exploitation of civilians and minerals. Even though this number is somewhat in contention, roughly 5.4 million people have died as a result of the conflict, making it the deadliest war since World War II. Over 20 armed groups compete for resources in a theater of total impunity. And as you can imagine, those who pay the cost of the war are the civilians themselves. Sexual violence is a particularly salient and devastating feature of the war. Human Rights Watch called sexual violence in Democratic Republic of the Congo as a weapon of war, and a top humanitarian UN official called the DRC the worst place in the world to be a woman. Many of us are aware of the challenges that exist in trying to study sexual violence in even very developed contexts like the United States. Extrapolate those difficulties to a place like DRC, which has no kind of public health infrastructure, nor does it have roads or easy transportation. As you can imagine, reporting of sexual violence is extremely poor, and there's an additional factor, which is intense stigma around being a victim of sexual violence that prevents women from coming forward to seek care or to report what happened to them. This is particularly important in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and it will be kind of a foundational theme of the presentation going forward. A very brief note about HHI's research agenda. We really try to take a mixed methods approach to understanding complex and evolving problems like those that exist in DRC. Over the course of the two decades that the conflict has been going on, the problem of sexual violence has changed throughout the war. So we try to use mixed methods research, which involves surveys, focus groups, key informant interviews, and talk to many different populations, including women, men, service providers, community leaders, to kind of triangulate in or to build a puzzle of what's going on. And as we hear certain themes arising from all of these different groups at the same time, we become aware of which problems are really overarching. So this particular project will examine how men and women both talk about and experience sexual violence in their communities. This research was precipitated by a small survey that HHI did in Eastern DRC that found that 1 in 6 women were rejected by a male relative after being raped in the war. This rejection is basically the most extreme form of stigma that a woman can experience, where a male relative will no longer allow her to stay in the household. And 1 in 17 women, it reported that they were actually rejected from their entire community as a result of experiencing this kind of violence. So it's a very salient problem, and it can be devastating for women as you think about the fact that being rejected from her house means women are often left to live on the streets, taking care of children, and then often have to resort to transactional sex to make a living. So really feeds into that cycle of violence. We started by asking both men and women in focus groups that were separated. So we had male focus groups and female focus groups to enable people to speak in a more open manner, how they just defined or thought about sexual violence. And as many of us would kind of identify with, both men and women said sexual violence was having sex with a woman against her will. But really interestingly, men also viewed rape and sexual violence as destruction as a whole, so an existential threat to their society in the DRC. So one man said, rape is destruction. Another said, the problem of rape is destroying our households and families. Foreigners are coming and raping our wives, devastating them. That's why we say those people are ruining our communities. So we really see this problem as almost a security issue for the entire community, as opposed to an individual issue that just has to do with STIs or physical effects. We also found that sexual violence changed the perceived value of women as daughters, wives, or prospective wives. One woman said very eloquently, "If you're a girl who's been raped, your parents will start mistreating you. You'll never get married. They'll throw you away because you're not worth anything. You lose all your value because no one will marry you." And so again, you see this kind of pervasive destabilizing effect of one of these forms of violence. We also found really interesting that, interestingly, that communal attitudes towards adultery were now being applied to non-consensual sex, and that community kind of norms had adapted in somewhat negative ways to address sexual violence in DRC. As one woman said, if you have sex outside of your marriage, nobody will consider you a woman. But it's really interesting here because there's no distinction, right, between being adulterous and having sex outside of marriage or being forced by 20 armed men to have sex outside of marriage. We often found that these norms applied particularly to situations around family care. So women who were survivors said that they were often not allowed to nurse their babies or to care for their husbands when their husbands were sick. So one woman says, "In my village, when the husband is sick, customs don't allow women who've committed adultery or have had sex with anyone else to look after their husbands." And again, you see that complete conflating, right, of these two forms of sex outside of marriage, which are consensual and the non-consensual. Yes, here we are. Okay. So a very powerful theme that emerged over and over throughout the focus groups was the sense of haya, which is the Swahili word for shame. So survivors both view themselves and are viewed by their family as contaminated in both a physical sense, so people are afraid that they carry STIs or HIV, and a moral sense. So as one man said, "How can you feed yourself with spoiled food?" And this was his metaphor for describing why he couldn't keep a woman who'd been raped within his house. And then a broad recognition by both men and women that rejection occurs. So this woman said, "Your husband will say he can't keep a woman who's been raped by the whole battalion, and he'll abandon you. When you go to your parents' house, they'll ask you why you have destroyed your marriage." So these are the points of general consensus between men and women. But some of the most interesting points of the research came when we found the perceptual differences between the two groups. So let's turn to the men's perspective. Often people are less willing to hear men's perspectives in this case. They're really demonized. Like, how could men possibly reject a woman after she's been through this incredibly traumatic experience? And what we found by having these male-only focus groups is that they really experienced intense trauma themselves, and that's one of the reasons that they rejected women from their households. So one man said, men whose wives have been raped feel ill at ease. They've lost their dignity and self-esteem. You lose your pride and you're worth nothing. We also found that men's reactions after rape is a crucial factor for a woman's long-term health and recovery. So one man stepping forward to accept a survivor after this experience could be incredibly powerful in helping her to kind of get the care she needed to rebuild her life. And so one intervention that women were very positive about was saying, if NGOs show your husbands that you are free from STIs or HIV, it'll help you get accepted back into your home. And then, of course, the corollary of this is that if you are infected, he'll reject you immediately. So you need good programming around both of those outcomes. So this is kind of a way to turn the problem on its head. We found that, yes, almost one-third of women were rejected from their households, but that also means two-thirds of women weren't. And so by understanding men's perspectives, we can leverage that two-thirds of the positive outcomes and find better interventions. I'll just move past and say that both women, again, talked about the importance of economic solutions, but looked at it in a very different way. Women said that economics were a way to help them heal after a traumatic event, whereas men said that lack of jobs and poor economic opportunities were a reason that men might rape. And so again, talking about the same issue, but with different kind of perceptions. So just a quick note about some of the implications of this research. I think something that really resonated from the previous presentation was how conflict and violence can often feed continuing cycles of violence. And doing research like this, where you really thoughtfully address the perceptions and attitudes of different groups and find the areas of consensus and the areas of difference, we can begin to find positive ways to break those cycles of violence. One of the ways to do this is to understand and leverage the power that men have. Instead of demonizing them and saying that they're the source of the problem, we can use men as a pivotal intervention point to help survivors continue to heal. We can reframe those traditions that were used negatively to support, not stigmatize, survivors. My co-investigator, Justin Kabanga, who's the head of the local organization we work with, uses a really wonderful metaphor when he says, there's a Congolese tradition that says a seed, even if you don't plant it in your own field, can grow beautiful fruit. And so this is a way that he uses a local kind of maxim to say that you can support women who've become impregnated from sexual violence. So even if you didn't plant the seed, you can reap the benefit of having an extra child in your family. And I think it's just very interesting how he reframes those kind of traditions. Without a strengthened justice system, sexual violence threatens to become normalized within society, and economic solutions are vital to the recovery of DRC, a finding supported by both men and women. So, just on a closing note, as we strive to achieve social justice, even in these highly complex and unstable contexts, research can help illuminate the stumbling blocks, roles of different actors, and ways forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We have time for at least a couple of questions over here, please. Yes.
Yeah.
Can you summarize it?
So the question was, how can we recognize that sexual violence is also a problem that affects men? And to use that as a way to say that it might be a universal problem without diminishing, you know, the cost for women. And so I will say that that's an incredibly important and excellent question, that we actually see much higher rates of abuse of men in DRC than we'd previously thought. A recent population-based study showed very, very high rates of sexual violence against men. And one of the things that I find from my kind of anecdotal experience is if you go to a very small rural clinic in the middle of kind of nowhere, you'll see an intake form, and women will be listed as survivors of rape, and men will be listed as survivors of torture. And if you dig a little bit deeper and ask what that torture was, it's pretty much the same form of violence. And you also have other forms of torture that include castration and burning and humiliation and things like that. But it's incredible that's the socially acceptable form of admitting rape for men. And I think we have to be very thoughtful about the ways that we construct our definitions to capture that.
We have time for at least one more. How about wait right there in the back? Yes, right here. Yes.
In my research, I've seen that in Nigeria, for example, and in the Congo, that there's also a lot of residual attitude that creates situations where there continues to be violence, even when maybe the war is slowing down or finished. Did you see anything from that in your research, and do you have any suggestions about how to minimize that attitude that is acceptable to rape others or to be violent from men and women?
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. Something I didn't quite have time to cover in this presentation is that both men and women have intense concerns about the kind of upcoming generation, and getting back to that theme of cycles of violence, they say that young men really look towards successful models of manship that they see, and that includes basically forming small fake militias, and that's a model that we see for young civilian men in DRC. The positive corollary of that is that the men we speak to in focus groups kind of have this heart cry for better education around what sexual violence is. You know, even domestic violence isn't fully understood, so we need to understand those kinds of things going forward, and we certainly need to understand how to better educate young men, because no matter what happens with the conflict itself, there'd be these high levels of trauma and residual violence that occur in communities. And so it'll be a problem, I think, that echoes across generations and will need to be specifically addressed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.